The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Care and protection for the whole family's health at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Good morning, it's David O'Reilly with you again between now and 1 o'clock. It's a brisk summer morning, blue sky, sun is shining where we are, and I hope where you are this morning as well. So I suppose why not bask in the glory of these small wins and spoonful of positivity which have been short in supply over recent months. And speaking of winning, Rachel Blackmore beams from the front pages of almost all of the papers today. So I suppose let's take a look at the papers now, beginning with the Irish Sunday Mirror, because it devotes indeed its full front page to the Killinall County Tipperary native. Victory or history maker, victory in Empty Aintree. Irish jockey Rachel is the first woman to win the Grand National. She won it yesterday on Manila Times, trained of course by Waterford's Henry de Bromhead, and this is to add to her wonderful successes in Cheltenham as well. So that's on the front page of the Irish Sunday Mirror, and again on the front of the Daily Star Sunday. Bookies get battering as Rachel becomes first woman to win the National, and a fantastic shot there of the joy as she crosses the line in Liverpool yesterday. And of course the horse priced at 11 to 1, so a lot of people happy this morning of having put a bet on Rachel. Photograph is there. Unbelievable feeling. Rachel makes racing history. That's on the front of the Sunday Independent. But their main story is scramble for flights here to beat mandatory quarantine. A cabinet memo warns of overreach. So this is the story that people are scrambling in the US in particular to book flights and get home here before the mandatory quarantine kicks in for people arriving from the US next Thursday morning, I think at 4 a.m. or something like that in the morning. The Sunday Times again, Aintree hails the real National Velvet. Another fantastic shot there of Rachel. And their story, their main banner story, is no waste when vaccine offer twice, says HSE. So a lot of people are getting 2 and 3 invitations to go and get the vaccine, but the HSE says despite this technical glitch or computer glitch or whatever it is that leads to people getting the vaccine and then getting an invite to go for their first jab, they're saying that there are no doses being actually wasted in that scenario. The Irish Mail, ain't that grand, Rachel wins National, their front page pick. And 100 disability staff got jabs before clients. Admin workers told to pose as frontline staff on HSE portal. And that's a story by Michael O'Farrell. And it's a similar story to one that they had last Sunday, and indeed that the Mail has been focusing on in recent weeks with regards to so-called queue jumping when it comes to getting the jab. Now, the Business Post, They go with the story in relation to FBD. FBD seeks to deduct the value of pandemic state supports from payouts. So as you know, there are a lot of policyholders in the hospitality sector in particular that obviously there was a test case last year and FBD lost that and basically must pay out now as a result and pay out on those policies. But now they're saying, well, take down and deduct all of the government supports and staff supports, and we'll give you what's left. That's the gist of that story. So people in the hospitality sector will be interested to read up on that. It's in the Business Post. The Irish Sun on Sunday, another pick there of Rachel. And then Farewell Shay, showbiz world plunged into grief. And this is about, of course, the sad passing of Eurovision legend Shay Healy, who passed away Friday night stroke yesterday morning at the age of 78. We spoke about it on the programme yesterday. And in the Sunday World, Snapchat predator walks free. And that's a story there, an exclusive by Patrick O'Connell in the Sunday World. Okay, my panel who are with me here this morning, I'm joined by Dervil MacDonald, of course, and Dervil is author and broadcaster, and Anthony Staines, Professor of Health Systems in DCU. And joining us remotely is Darren McCaffrey, who is now the political editor with GB News, which is set to launch in the UK very, very soon. Good morning to you all. Anthony, for the last 12 months, we've been leading with negative stories, negative stories. But sure, we have to go this morning with the positive story from yesterday.
And it's such an amazing story. This woman, Rachel Blackmore, has won the biggest horse racing event in the world. And she has shown over the last years that she's one of the greatest jockeys ever. So that's an amazing achievement for anyone. And it's an astonishing achievement for an Irish woman. So I think we should all be so proud today. You know, Ireland has a long tradition of great jockeys, great horses, great trainers. And Rachel stands four square in that tradition.
Derval?
Yeah, listen, it was absolutely fantastic to see Rachel Blackmore yesterday. I love what she said after the race to reporters when they asked her about obviously this monumental achievement of being the first woman to break that. And she said, I don't feel male or female right now. I don't even feel human. And it was just fantastic. But, you know, even Hayley Turner, she was one of the first female jockeys to win 100 flat races. And she paid tribute to her saying, for all the girls who watched National Velvet, that was the Elizabeth Taylor view. She says thank you so much. But for me, it was seeing the first woman elected as a provost to my alma mater, Trinity, but also seeing the women and the rugby. Yes, it was a great weekend for women, but also just to recognise the sheer you know, graft and talent and hard work that went into it yesterday. And can you imagine, no crowd, no nothing there for her, but the amount of outpouring for Rachel today is absolutely superb.
Yeah, I think 10 of the first 11 horses Irish trained really are dominating racing over there. And Henry de Bromhead, as you were saying earlier, Anthony, as well, from Waterford, and the limelight being stolen from him, he won't mind, but 1-2 yesterday and 1-2 in the Gold Cup in Cheltenham as well. Yeah. So it's a real great positive story.
He's one of our most successful trainers now. Yeah. His achievements are extraordinary from a very, very small base 10 years ago. Yeah. He's really become one of the great trainers, one of the legendary trainers.
All right. Well, we'll have more later in the programme. We'll have more reaction to that, as you said, historic win yesterday. But we're just going to get back to brass tacks, as it were. And Derval, the story on the front of the Sunday Independent this morning from Hugh O'Connell and Fergal O'Connor. But Hugh and Fergal and the Sunday Independent, over the last number of weeks, they've been keeping a close eye on the figures in terms of visitors coming in here at a time when we have this discussion about quarantine and mandatory quarantine, and obviously the spread of new variants throughout the country. So what's this all about? The scramble for flights here to mean mandatory quarantine. So people are coming in from the US over the next few days to try and beat the mandatory quarantine?
And I suppose in some senses that's not unexpected. You know, people are going to change their behaviour and change their plans if they think there's a better chance of getting in early rather than being sitting for 2 weeks, you know, in a hotel. It's been, for me, it's been a really, really interesting debate around mandatory quarantine, not least because, you know, there have been these kind of clarion calls that we should go down a very sort of zero COVID approach. We're always kind of being pointed out with jurisdictions such as, you know, Japan, South Korea, you know, Australia and New Zealand, without really contemplating the complexities that we have here on the island of Ireland in respect of it, and also just, you know, the backlash against it as well, because no sooner had we introduced it that we had all of the stories about how terrible people were being treated. I found it really interesting watching actually New Zealand in particular this weekend, because for the first time, because of the surge in cases in India, in fact, despite the fact that it's one of the countries that supplies a lot of the ingredients for vaccines, but for the first time they are restricting entry to New Zealand of its own residents and nationals, you know, if they have been there. It's a very, very complicated issue. The fact that people are trying to kind of, there's been a sort of a surge in people coming home isn't surprising, but it is, and I think will remain for quite some time, probably quite a complicated issue here.
Darren, good morning to you. You're very welcome. You're joining us from London, I believe, and congratulations on the new appointment. But your take on this?
Yeah, well, first of all, I've been through quarantine because I only arrived here a couple of weeks ago. And clearly, it is slightly different in the UK in that they don't have the hotel quarantine for quite the same number of countries as Ireland has. But, you know, it's pretty damn difficult to get in, or at least cumbersome in the sense that you do need to obviously have a PCR test. You do need to fill in your passenger locator form. You do need to quarantine for those 10 days. And in the UK, you have to book and paid for tests in advance on the second and eighth day. And they, you know, they do check up on you. They do call every day. I think in many ways, though, we have to understand that this debate about hotel quarantine and what's happening, and there are big implications. You know, obviously, I've just moved from Brussels And the Commission will not be happy because they would see some of the actions being taken by the Irish government as disproportionate. At the end of the day, they are discriminated against different EU citizens. But ultimately, it's because governments can't trust people and they can't trust their own populations. Because actually, if they could just trust everyone to do the right thing, there would be no need to actually confine people in hotels. I mean, if everyone's stuck by the rules, which is that you stay at home, for the first 10, 14 days after you get back, there would be no need for this. And I think it's part of a wider story that we've seen throughout this entire pandemic, that when it gets down to it, governments feel that they can't trust their own populations to do the right thing. And that's, you know, in many ways, that's quite a sad reflection on all of us to a large degree, but also questions, you know, what is the role of the government in this pandemic? Is it simply to try and corral all of us kind of do the right thing with merely the stick of the state, which is either fining people or threatening with them with imprisonment if they don't do the right thing?
Well, can I bring you in, Anthony, at this point? Are the government now, they're finally doing the right thing?
I think they're starting to do the right thing. I mean, it's not as simple as Darren makes out, because many people find it really hard to isolate at home. If you have a one bedroom apartment which you share with three other people, how do you isolate? You can't. You actually can't. It's not physically possible.
But have people not been doing that over the last 12 months or so, that have been told to go home, stay in your room, leave the breakfast, dinner and tea outside the door?
That assumes you have a room. I mean, there's a whole suite of assumptions built into those comments, which are not true for many people. And people underestimate how infectious this virus is. Most of us don't have much experience of infectious disease because we largely control it through public health measures, vaccination, sanitation and what have you, and we can treat it. This one we can't control through the routine measures we have in place. It is much more infectious than anything we're accustomed to, except measles. And that's the problem. It's really hard to control the spread of this. So if you do the sums, you have enough people coming in from abroad carrying infection entirely innocently, not aware that they're sick, to sustain an ongoing epidemic in the country. Even if nobody transmits inside the country, there's enough transmission coming in from outside to keep it going. And that's just reality. And until we get to a situation where there's much higher levels of control, much higher levels of vaccination, we're kind of stuck with that. And it is very difficult. I mean, these questions need to be asked. These questions need to be raised. We need to think very carefully about what we're doing. But we actually do need to do it. And I think we are probably doing it a little bit better than some countries. But the European law seems to be fairly clear. Micheál MacDoul was explaining it on the radio the other day. As long as we don't discriminate between our own citizens and other EU citizens, these kinds of restrictions are allowed. And many other EU states have brought in restrictions, some of them quite draconian. The Germans closed the German-Czech border and thousands of people go across that border to work every day. But they still closed it.
Can I just pick up on this point about the cost of things and the idea that being put forward there that people might not have room themselves to self-isolate? I mean, first of all, I would make the argument that, you know, most people travelling or who have been travelling in and out of places clearly have some means to do so. So I suspect that's a very small percentage of people who wouldn't have a room to go back to because they would be sharing with someone else. But even if that was true, so what then? They are then punished by having to pay, you know, what, nearly 2,000 euros. Where do they get that money from? If they're living in a place where, you know, they can't afford a room on their own that they're having to share, we're then expecting the state or is expecting them to pay, you know, quite a substantial sum of money. And we do have to mitigate this point. I know there's been talk about Erasmus students returning home. There's a case where I think a woman has proven that she's fully vaccinated and wants to go back for a funeral and yet still can't get around this. And I come back to this point of we can't get away from the fact that the rules, I think, as they are or as they have been, if they were adhered to, would probably be enough. And this is a reflection that state feels it can't trust its own people.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. Actually, Dara, there's congrats on the new role. But there's an interesting piece by Orla Muldoon in today's Business Post, which highlights two interesting points. And one is that, according to polling by Amaroc, the fear of COVID is at its lowest level since March of last year. But at the same time, our public health recommendations, compliance with those are also at an all-time low as well. So that seems to be a fairly dangerous mix. I think sometimes one of the things where we go wrong is we hone in on one specific measure, such as vaccination, such as quarantine, without actually realising this is a multifaceted problem. And what I find interesting about reading the newspapers this week, you always kind of know if there's a unanimity in the main editorials or in kind of the main commentary, and there isn't today. So you've seen a lot of pressure in the newspapers talking obviously about business. We'd similar things in the run up to Christmas. You know, a lot of the good news coming through is that we're going to have nearly 4 million doses by the end of June. 2 million, I think, of those which are going to be Pfizer. You know, so it is a multifaceted thing. And one of the things I think about the stage of the pandemic that we're in is that if we've been in lockdown for so long, and that can't happen permanently, but if our numbers aren't come down, obviously our hospitalisation numbers have come down, particularly amongst the age group that we saw the lot of our fatalities. So we've got hospitalisations coming down, ICU numbers coming down, but our numbers of people still getting it. And I drove in today to RTE past the Balls Bridge COVID testing centre and was initially went, is there a queue? God, is there a match on today? And then I went, no, there isn't. That is people going in with their masks on because they're getting tested today. And one of the things
I thought you were going to say they were queuing to get coffee, which is another which is phenomenon, another. Obviously.
But people are actually queuing to get their COVID test this morning. Yeah. And it is sort of just a reminder, like, I mean, again, what Orla was saying is that, you know, a lot of people, you know, may not know, I do, sadly, but may not know people who have died of COVID, but they might know of somebody who lost their lives to suicide or lost their lives to another thing. So sometimes it's very complex, but I think that if we're honing in one specific thing, and I just thought that was interesting just about the coverage this morning, it will be interesting to have this conversation in 6 to 8 weeks' time.
Yeah.
When we see the impact of the vaccinations and to see will there be such a reliance on other tougher measures.
It's probably the fewest amount of opinion pieces in the Sunday papers collectively on COVID because there are other issues, one which we're going to come to presently. Yeah. But Anthony, just before we finish on this, you being the medic and somebody that's been very close to all of this, we have a text in here. How long are we going to lock out Irish citizens abroad for? The policy will marginalise the poorest and most vulnerable of our citizens abroad, many of whom won't be able to afford 2 weeks of hotel quarantine. Now that comes in from Alan, and I think I saw a tweet yesterday from Senator Regina Doherty on this, not necessarily going against government policy, but asking the question that a lot of people are probably going to ask now. So we're into this mandatory hotel quarantine scenario, but do we have an end game? At what stage do we start relaxing? At what stage can we open up Merrion Row and Capel Street to outdoor dining again? Based on the figures that you're looking at and studying, Anthony, and as the medic, and for people listening to us now, where are we going as we enter the summer now?
There's two questions there. The first is, how do we control the virus in Ireland? And we should do it the same way we almost did it last summer, which would have avoided the last year of lockdown, more or less, which is basic public health measures. And we're not doing that. We're still having arguments about how many people work in public health, basic information systems for public health, contact tracing, source investigation. All of that is still a year into the pandemic, not up to scratch. But if we did that, we'd open Capel Street, we'd open Merrion Row, we'd have had them open for months. Mandatory hotel quarantine depends on vaccination, testing and rates in other countries. So it's very largely down to what's going on in other countries, not in our country. Now, I am of the view the state should pay for mandatory quarantine for everyone coming in. So I know that's not popular, but that's my view.
I know we should never go down the road of predicting, we don't know. But just as I said, based on the analysis that you see at the moment, briefly, are we looking forward to a situation at the end of June, beginning of July, when the majority of the adult population is vaccinated, that we can start looking forward slowly but surely to relative normality again?
No. We're looking forward to that in the autumn, which is when most people will have had two doses of vaccines. And that it's going to take that long. We've just seen this week AstraZeneca, first of all, promised huge deliveries and then had to row back on those promises. And that's in the last 3 days. Mm. So we're going to be as we are pretty much till autumn. Everyone in the business is praying that the new strains stay under control, because we know that the new strains are not fully covered.
And there's no guarantee, Anthony, that we won't develop one of our own, like a Clonakilty or a Newry or something else variant.
None.
Well, and that's the risk we're all running.
All right. Now, it's unfair to be asking people. We've done it so much over the last 2 months. Can you tell us when and when and when and when? We just don't know. But things are beginning to look positive, as you're saying, in terms of hospital numbers, if that's a barometer, and ICU numbers, which is a key figure to look at. Like, I'll leave the last word to you on that one, Anthony, and move on now to what, as I said, Darren, is dominating the papers today in terms of opinions from different commentators, and that is the North. Now, you're a native, of course, as well. From where you're looking on, what do you make of what's been happening over the last 7 days?
So really interesting, first of all, there's a story in the Irish edition of the Sunday Times today talking about how apparently thousands of loyalists have circulated a video pinpointing the location of the Irish government's permanent residency in Belfast, and there's concern that actually these kind of rather sporadic rioting and violence that we've seen over the last, what, 8-9 days or so could actually become kind of more politically targeted, and there's fears that actually they may shift to more symbolic targets, including that permanent residency in Belfast for the Irish government. I think on the whole, you know what, in many ways we should be probably unsurprised, rather unfortunately, about the violence that we've seen over the last week or so.
What's at the heart of it, in your opinion?
Well, so I think, you know, there's a whole, we've seen lots of things come together. First of all, clearly there is unionist and loyalist anger about the Northern Ireland Protocol and this idea, even if you don't understand the intricacies of what's actually happening, this idea that Great Britain and Northern Ireland, that there is a big piping border down the Irish Sea now, and that Northern Ireland is not, in terms of economic terms, part of the rest of the United Kingdom to a large degree. Clearly, there's also anger about the Bobby Story funeral and the lack of prosecutions from that, not helped, of course, by Arlene Foster and other unions calling for the police constable to resign. I'm not entirely sure that was helpful. But in addition to that, we've had a year of lockdown. It's one of the most socially deprived parts of the United Kingdom, these parts of East, North and South Belfast. And in addition to that, we're seeing yet again a stream of unionism and loyalism in a year in which we're going to see a census probably that shows there's more Catholics than Protestants in Northern Ireland. And this is why my fear is this is far from the end of this. A unionism that feels cornered, it feels on the defensive. It can see the possibility of a border poll or possible United Ireland going down the line. And there's an awful lot of anxiety about that. And, you know, I remember when I was kind of growing up, I only got the tail end of the Troubles. But the natural reaction, you have to remember, of people in Northern Ireland to a large degree is to express what other people might do in peaceful protests or other ways is to turn to violence because it's so bred into a degree into the psyche of people in Northern Ireland. So, you know, what other people might do to express that anxiety in other parts of Ireland or the UK or Europe, it means that it has got a more violent tinge in Northern Ireland because that's simply what's happened for the last 30, 40 years, unfortunately.
Are you surprised, Darren, and as I said, you were in Brussels for a long time, you're now in London, but are you surprised that there isn't more of a media focus as to what's happening? As they say, if there was rioting in Finchley, it will be on the front of all the UK papers, but it was barely mentioned. What does that say about the attitude of quote-unquote mainlanders towards Northern Ireland?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I tweeted about this actually on Monday saying, you know, if this violence was happening, and by that stage about 40 police officers being injured, I think it's now closer to 80. If that was happening, you're right, in Birmingham or Brighton or Blackpool, it would be a massive rolling news story. Now, Northern Ireland has always been viewed as a different place by most people in Britain. It's fair to say, I think most people don't understand the complexity of it and aren't terribly interested in it. And there's a feeling amongst news editors that it is just the same story that kind of goes around in a cycle every so often, and there's not that much interest in it. But I think it's really important there should be, because, you know, a part of this and part of why it has happened is because of Brexit. And in part, that's because actually before the referendum, no one was terribly interested in Northern Ireland. And now no one seems terribly interested in the consequences. And at the end of the day, whatever you think, like, Northern Ireland is still part of the UK. It's the same country. Mm-hmm. And whether people like it or not, and I'm sat here in London, they have to be and should be interested in Northern Ireland. But I think you're right. It's a reflection that many people simply, they just don't care is the bottom line. They don't care. And that's true, it must be said, I think, of people down south as well. You know, I lived in Dublin for a year. There's a lot of people down south who don't understand or care that much about the North either, it must be said.
That is quite true, actually. And Derval, just when we talk there about the reasoning behind what we're seeing in recent days, and maybe the British media are right, maybe you know, we here are probably over exaggerating what's going on there, because it is, you know, nobody's been killed, thank God, and we shouldn't, and that won't happen, although we had the Lira McKee, obviously, death 2 year anniversary, I think, yesterday. This weekend. But just going back to the reason for what we're seeing in the north, and the pictures of young people in their teens throwing petrol bombs and missiles at the police. Now, is this a reflection of recent political decisions that have been made with regards to Brexit, with regards to the Bobby Storey funeral, with regards to talk about border poll? Or is it more to do with the fact that people in these areas are very, very deprived and have been forgotten about by Westminster and forgotten about and neglected by Stormont, you could say?
You know, it's kind of all of the above. I attempted for the Sunday Independent today to try and capture a lot of the reasons behind it. And it's interesting, you know, when you mentioned Lira McKee, I remember sitting down 2 years ago this week with a US delegation led by Nancy Pelosi. You know, we were talking at a round table about Brexit, and we were talking about this risk of violence, and everybody around the table was trying to go, look, we're not overstating it, but, you know, you've got to understand about the social deprivation, which is a cross-community facet in Northern Ireland, but also saying there are a lot of factors just lying beneath. And tragically, the following night, when Richard Neal, the very important chairman of the Ways and Means Committee in the US, he was receiving an award in the University of Ulster, McGee and Derry. And that was the night that Lira McKee was shot. And I was writing about her today because what she really, really captured was the ceasefire baby generation. So those young people who were born after the ceasefires. But, you know, the young rioters that you saw all of this week, some as young as 12 or 13, who weren't even born when the Good Friday Agreement, which guaranteed their British identity, was signed. You know, they weren't even born when that had happened. There are big long-term structural issues. There's no doubt that Brexit has really kind of struck at the heart of the Good Friday Agreement, which allowed for that fluid identity. You could be British or Irish or both. And obviously then this anger around the protocol. It was interesting, one of the young rioters was interviewed and he was saying, look, you know, we don't really understand about all of that. All we know is that Sinn Féin are winning. All that we know is that the Republicans are winning, and that's all we hear. Another young rioter reportedly, I haven't been able to confirm it where it was, but another young rioter reportedly, when pressed about the protocol, says, well, it's just about Sinn Féin. And he says, well, what about it? And they said, we're angry because the PSNI didn't arrest Bobby Storey, and Bobby Storey was, of course, dead. But it is factors like that, such as the Bobby Storey funeral, and I won't go into it because there's been so many acres of newsprint written about it, but that was an offence to people of all faiths and none. And particularly, actually, when you look at the plans for Prince Philip's funeral and others, you know, there was real anger about that. But there's no doubt that the protocol, that Brexit, that issues that go to heart of identity are behind this. Some of it is being manufactured. Another big factor you have to take into account, which is actually a stunning success for the PSNI and Revenue and others, was the crackdown on the South East Antrim UDA, which is really cracked down in paramilitarism. My goodness, if they deployed that force in South Armagh as well, that would be kind of really seen as a big thing for policing. And there have been missteps by the PSNI in the same way there have been missteps by others, but the joint attacks by both Sinn Féin and DUP on policing, on the impartiality of policing in Northern Ireland, which is one of the pillars of those peace processes, is also another dangerous factor. So you have all of these things coming together almost like a perfect storm. And just a couple of weeks ago, I was on the Clare Byrne programme on the debate about a united Ireland, and a very civilised, a very considered debate in many respects. When you look at what we've seen all this week, we must actually be thinking, we need to tread very carefully on this one in terms of consent and identity and all of those big issues.
And Anthony, just on that, about political leadership in Stormont, led by the power-sharing executive of the DUP and Sinn Féin, how important is language at this point in time?
I think language and respect matter hugely, and there's been a lot of very aggressive conversation on both sides of that divide. But what you're dealing with at base is two communities that have been abandoned by their political leaders. And they're only used on both sides, one by Sinn Féin, one by the DUP. And they're both used as foot soldiers. But they don't get
the working
education.
The working class, regardless of whether they're orange or green, has been forgotten about, is what you're saying.
The standard of education in Northern Ireland in parts of Belfast is extraordinarily poor. Their education system is like a fossil from the 1950s in Britain. It doesn't work very well. It's a sectarian system. The polling evidence says that most people want an integrated system. They still have grammar schools. They still have very much the secondary modern attitude to education. And the jobs that these communities depended on don't exist anymore. but they haven't been given alternatives. Mm. I've canvassed those parts for the SDLP, and it's frightening what you meet.
Yeah, Darren?
Can I just add to this in kind of a personal context to agree? I mean, I went to one of those kind of Catholic grammar schools, and actually what we forget is, we must not lose context in this. This week, people said it was a return to the bad old days, and as someone pointed out, it's not, because if you remember the bad old days, you'd know that this is nothing like it. So we shouldn't get carried away with it. But the big problem is when people focus on the peace process, they focus on things like bombs and bullets. And thankfully, we're a long way from that. What they don't focus on is actual integration. You know, I was 18 years old before I met someone who was a different faith from me. I mean, I was brought up a Catholic. I did not have any Protestant friends at all until I went to university in England. And I have to say, you know, when I grew up, and I was, 12 years old when the Good Friday Agreement was signed, so I don't really remember the Troubles. But what I do remember is that when I sat on the school bus, the Catholics sat at the front and the Protestants sat at the back. That my local village, where my parents live, is 97% Catholic. The next one along is almost exclusively Protestant. There are Catholic bars, there are Catholic newspapers. There are essentially everything you can almost divide. I think there are still bus stops in Belfast that are Catholic and Protestant. And of course, there are more peace wars in Belfast now than there have ever been, so-called peace wars. Until you sort that out, we properly sort that out, it's going to be so difficult to get away from, I think, what Devler was referring to, the us and them.
But isn't that what the 1998 Belfast Agreement / Good Friday Agreement was all about? 23 years later, and here we are still talking about that hate.
These are the issues that, again, I'd be very similar. I grew up as a Catholic in Newry, and, you know, I think I've said this recently, like, you know, when we were very young, when you didn't kind of know fully the political reality, but we used to ask each other in the playground, are you a cup or a plate? You know, we didn't know what it meant, but it meant, are you Catholic or Protestant? And that kind of, you know, and we did, like, one of the reasons why I found Derry Girls so funny was because we did those programmes. I think it was called EMU, Education for Mutual Understanding, where, you know, the Catholic school was brought to meet the Protestant school and everything, you know, but there was that segregation. And one of the, when you look at the metrics, and Naomi Long on that same programme on RTE, Claire Burns, pointed this out, and it's a point I've made before, you know, more than 9 out of 10 of our children in Northern Ireland are still segregated in terms of education. It's the same when you go and look at the divisions.
So the more things change, the more they stay the same, it seems.
But here's the problem, look, there's a lot of things that the Good Friday Agreement, and you should read, if you want just a bit of a happier, lighter kind of take on it. Joe Brawley has been talking about how that, yes, despite all of the horror this week, you know, there is a lot of cross-community things. Like, I mean, the sting was taken out of this a lot this week, largely because on those exact same peace walls, community leaders, including local football teams on both sides and all of that, came together and tried to, you know, to pull
and
apart.
Joe was writing in the main part of the window. Just before we leave this, Darren, can I go back to you and talk to you about Boris? Somewhere today in one of the papers, somebody's writing about he may be remembered as the Prime Minister that breaks up the union. It was you, wasn't it? All right, Carol. I knew it was a great piece that stuck in my mind. But okay, well done on that. So anyway, Darren, there was a wonderful journalist who wrote a great piece today where she said that Boris will be remembered for breaking up the union. Is this wonderful award-winning journalist far wrong?
No, you should finish that clause.
Well, I know, but
it is in the context of the Scottish independence referendum.
Does he care? Does he care, Darren? That's what I want to know.
I think all politicians care about the legacy. And my word, it would be quite a legacy to be, you know, the Prime Minister that led to the breakup of the UK. I think in many regards, people have been rightly critical of Boris Johnson this week, saying, you know, if this was another Prime Minister, they would be picking up the phone, cancelling whatever's happening this week and talking to parties in Northern Ireland and trying to bang heads together. Boris Johnson's not done that. And so you could rightly claim or ask how much he actually cares. You know what, though? My summation is we've got elections in Scotland for the Scottish Parliament in just a couple of weeks' time. It is entirely possible that the SNP may well get a majority. There's even a possibility they might get a super majority alongside Alex Salmond's other party. Will that drive this debate about Scottish independence and calls for a second referendum? You bet it will.
Yeah.
Though by all estimations, Boris Johnson's digging in on that. All I would say is, and having listened to that Claire Byrne programme or watched it a couple of weeks ago as well, it reinforced in my mind that, you know, what Scottish independence, I don't think potentially probably will happen, but it's much more likely than a United Ireland at this stage. Scottish independence is a lot more straightforward than a United Ireland. I think a United Ireland, and I know Northern Ireland's celebrating its centenary in, a couple of weeks' time, May 3rd, it's still a long way off, because it's not just about Northern Ireland. It's about how it integrates itself into the rest of Ireland. And that is, as demonstrated by that programme and everything that's been talked about since, that is a hell of a task. Whereas Scottish independence is
a lot easier. And there's another election, Damien, to come up, just to follow on from Darragh, like next year. Whatever about this year being the centenary of the birth of Northern Ireland, next year is going to be very, very interesting. As I understand it, they're going to sensibly withhold the details of the census data that Darragh just recommended until after the election. That election could see, more likely than most, for the first time, the appointment of a Sinn Féin First Minister since the Good Friday Agreement. That would be, I would suspect, another major flashpoint for the Protestant Union loyalist community. It could see a groundswell towards alliance, and perhaps my great hope is that we would see a greater groundswell for a middle ground in Northern Ireland, because, of course, the fastest growing sort of population are those in Northern Ireland, are those who don't align to it.
Yeah.
Now, those figures came back slightly in Brexit, because, of course, the thing that Brexit has done is sort of force these binary issues once again. But so when you look at it, and it was funny, my colleague Amanda Ferguson, she was just kind of saying, every time you get asked to explain Northern Ireland, and, that easy question, what was behind the violence this week? And you have to kind of take a deep breath and go,
where do I begin?
Where would he start? Yeah. Can I just very, very, very briefly add to that, which is, essentially, and that's my concern about the future. My concern is, 100 years ago, we've seen unionist reaction in Northern Ireland with Home Rule and, the threat of violence. And my real concern is that actually, as the years now tick by, as may well happen next year, that Sinn Féin become the largest party in the Northern Irish Assembly, as those census figures come out, as a unionist community that feels abandoned by Britain to a large degree, but unwilling to contemplate a United Ireland, where do they turn to when they're cornered? And my fear is that we will continue to see sporadic violence like this over and over and over again, unfortunately. Because again, the underlying problems of Northern Ireland in terms of the division and the lack of integration
and perhaps,
have not been tackled.
Perhaps, Damien, I think it's, that if we saw that, it's what I talk about sometimes, my fear of the troubles in reverse, not on the same scale as what we've had, but perhaps, here to be a unionist minority. And you have to think, it's interesting, because I think the Sunday Times actually pictures the place in Belfast, which was known as Bertie's Bunker. But you would have to think, if in the future there's a Protestant unionist loyalist community, they mightn't just be going to Lanark Way to express their frustrations. And if there was sporadic violence, could it be violence that is not, as it was, as you say, quote unquote, the mainland earlier, but is it something that you could bring physically to your door here? It's a really, there's going to be a big challenge, and I think that's why this debate around United Ireland as opposed to Ireland, I think, has to be done very carefully.
Briefly answer.
There's
before
a
the
very
break.
Big piece of work for us to do, because people think United Ireland is just extending the reach of the Dáil to Belfast. It isn't. It's nothing like as simple as that, and we haven't even started considering what our state should look like to make it attractive to people in Northern Ireland so they have a choice. We haven't started thinking about
joint sovereignty. Well, the conversation has begun in earnest, though, you could say. And you could almost, say that Clare Byrne show was somewhat of a landmark regard.
Because it started a debate, and the tone, actually, interestingly, that was set at that debate by Marie Lou MacDonald and Leo Varadkar, it was generally a civilised debate that I thought that really captured, but the type of thing we need to do, it's a bit like the referendum we've had on other issues. It needs to have big conversations with trusted facilitators and people given room to breathe.
OK, we're going to leave that there for the moment. Stay with us. I'm joined here by Dervil MacDonald, Anthony Staines, and from London by Darragh McCaffrey.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
All right, Darragh McCaffrey, the other, of course, big story in the UK over the last few days has been the death of Prince Philip. Just briefly, the decision by the BBC to stop all programming on both BBC One and BBC Two and replace it, obviously, with a special programme right throughout the day, which was the same programme on both TV stations. The public reaction to that, what does that tell you, I suppose, about attitudes towards the monarchy?
Yeah, really fascinating, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, the BBC, it wasn't even just on TV. I mean, you're right, BBC One and Two broadcast the same thing. They took BBC Four off air. And for a time, all the BBC's radio stations as well were playing the same programme. And that was reflected also on ITV, to a large degree on Channel 4 and Channel 5. But the interesting thing, as you've rightly pointed out, is that viewing figures plummeted, essentially. You know, BBC One's figures were down 6%, but BBC Two's were down 65%, ITV 60% compared to the previous Friday. I think what it says is clearly, and the BBC somewhat interestingly have set up a dedicated complaints page on the website so people can register their complaints about this. I think to a large degree it reflects that maybe people do feel the kind of main broadcasters overdid it in terms of, you know, the sheer quantity of the coverage. You know, clearly it's very sad news, but at the same time, there is only so much you can say hour after hour about one man's life. And second of all, does it show that, I don't know, there's less interest in the monarchy? Possibly. But also that people have got choice these days. You know, 30, 40 years ago, you kind of had to watch BBC One or ITV. These days, everyone's got YouTube and Netflix and Amazon Prime and Disney Plus. And so, you know, you might watch it for 20, 30 minutes, but you don't have to sit and watch. Yeah. There are alternatives out there. So I think it's a really complex thing. But I think it does to a degree kind of play into this sense that there's just not as much deference towards the royal family. And that when these things happen, you know, we talk about a nation in mourning, but that means very different things to many different people.
Okay. And of course, a divisive opinion played out on social media very well over the weekend as well, from people that say, so what, to other people who said, may he rest in peace and our condolences to Queen Elizabeth. So people have different opinions. We may have, Dervil, before we finish up on this, we may have had, you know, an opinion, an image of him. There was a caricature of him, which it's emerging wasn't entirely accurate. So he was far more than this bumbling, gaff-ridden kind of...
Yeah, like when I think if you lead aside the slightly North Korean kind of coverage at the BBC, which actually gives a very good idea of the test run that's going to happen. Like, I mean, I saw some pictures on the A2 where they did these massive billboards, digital billboards with Prince Philip on it, you know, and I just thought if this was another country. Where I was really, really fascinated by actually was that, you know, the Prince Philip we know is kind of the older gentleman who was coming out kind of continually with these gaffes. But I was fascinated, and where I did kind of read and watch a lot of the coverage was looking at his early life, you know, and looking at this extraordinary journey that he came on, a life in exile. I'm learning French at the minute, so I watched an interview with him last night on French television, where he was, you know, speaking fluent French and, you know, and there was probably not, and his role in the Navy and everything. I also think that he has a little bit of a sense of humour. There's a wonderful picture in today's Daily Mail, and he wanted, instead of a hearse, he was involved in the design of this sort of lime green Land Rover.
Is this a true story now?
No, this is going to be used. So anyway, he was involved in the design of this lime green Land Rover that's going to be used as his hearse, you know, and if that is what we see going into coming down through Windsor, well, then it really will kind of be a little bit of a sense of humour.
Right. And the royal, it's the royal, obviously, funeral. Yeah. It is going to be next Saturday, and we hear that the two princes, William and Harry, are going to walk together, and there's going to be 30 people at it. And
the Sunday Times, if you're a royal watcher, the Sunday Times speculates on who the 30 will be. And of course, the big thing, and it'll be interesting in Darren's view on this, is it pure etiquette or not? But the fact that Boris Johnson won't be attending, ostensibly, you know, kind of to give way to, you know, to a member of the family. But that, even that is interesting.
Right. Okay, Camille, I want to move on because we, in the papers today as well, you know, we were reading and hearing about Shay Healy yesterday. We had a lovely tribute to him on the programme yesterday. But one of the things that was mentioned was the Nighthawks programme back in 1992. Shay was the presenter of this wonderful programme, probably before its time in a way. But he did an interview with Roscommon Fianna Fáil TD and former Minister for Justice Sean Doherty. Journalist and commentator Michael O'Regan. A lot of people know you, of course, from your time in the Dáil Gallery with the Irish Times. Very good morning to you, Michael. Will you remind us of the significance of this interview that Shay Healy did with Sean Doherty?
This was hugely significant, Damien. It brought down the most controversial Taoiseach in the history of the state, Charles Haughey. It happened in January 1992. Now, the background was that Sean Doherty, he had been a very controversial Minister for Justice in the short-lived Fianna Fáil minority government of 1982. He felt that he had taken the rap for the bugging of the phones of the journalists, Geraldine Kennedy and Bruce Arnold. He brooded a lot on that over the years. I know that from talking to him at the time. In 87, when Fianna Fáil went back into power, there was nothing for him, not even a junior ministry. He lost his Dáil seat in 89 and also failed to get elected to the European Parliament the same year. Now, he did get elected to the Seanad and became Cathaoirleach of the Seanad later, re-elected to the Dáil. So he was Cathaoirleach of the Seanad when he gave this interview to Shea Healy. And basically, you know, he used the phrase, this was information being gained for the most important boardroom in the country. He felt he had taken the rap unfairly. I think that was very well orchestrated at the time. By the way, leaving after the programme and going for a drink with Shea Healy, he was very anxious that Shea Healy understood the significance of what he had to say. Shea Healy rang Bruce Arnold, got him to look at the tape of the programme, and Bruce Arnold made it very clear, look, this is dynamite. At that time, you see, Damien, Albert Reynolds, surrounded by people like Pádraig Flynn, Máirgeagan Quinn, Noel Tracy and others, was attempting to unseat Charlie. And this was the final straw for the PDs. Charlie went.
You don't think it was stumbled upon? You think this was planned?
No, not at all. I think it was planned, Damien. If you look back, and I've listened back to what Sean Doherty had to say at that interview with Shea Healy. Also, by the way, later in that month, he had a press conference in the Montrose Hotel where he gave a statement, read out a statement, didn't take questions, saying that he had taken transcripts of the tape to Charlie Haughey's office. That, of course, was the final killer blow. Now, at the time, there was a journalist strike in RTE.
Yeah.
So it wasn't edited, actually. There was a long piece screened in the 9 o'clock news on that. Now, Sean Doherty left immediately after the statement. That statement, by the way, Damien, was certainly drafted with the help, I would think, of a PR company. Yeah. Now, I'm not the only one who thinks that Sean Doherty did not act alone. Stephen Collins, the Irish Times columnist, wrote a book some years ago called The Power Game. Mm. And he quotes Bertie Ahern, who knew one or two things about politics, also saying that Doherty did not act in isolation. And if I might quote Bertie, I don't know who set it up, but Ahern Flynn and the boys knew about it.
And of course, this came just a couple of years after the famous Brian Lenehan and I did not phone Áras an Uachtaráin scenario as well. So it was kind of, as I was saying yesterday, sort of our Watergate kind of moments. But it was a very significant interview in a most unlikely setting, but in an appropriately named place called Hell's Kitchen in County Roscommon. And I remember it actually quite well. And my old alma mater, Shannon Side Radio, they had a ball because RTÉ was on strike and
when you think just what Michael was saying, you know, because afterwards Doherty is kind of, you know, there's nothing worse when a source had to tell you. Now, do you get the import of what I'm telling you? I've been in that scenario a couple of times, but the fact that, but of course, like, I mean, that was, you know, he almost nearly stumbled and he had a huge part in that. But then you look at the great you know, spectrum of work and the contribution that he made. There's a wonderful interview, if you get a chance just to look into it, where Shea is interviewed. I was very lucky to have met him in the early part of my career. He was, of course, had ill health. Two things struck me. One, his absolute love for his wife was just, it was an unbelievable love story. But the second thing, he was interviewed and he said something, I just tweeted it out last night because it really resonated with me. He says, to remember to enjoy the climb, because sometimes the rewards are a climb, they're greater than the view. And he talked about the great adventures that he was on and how sometimes he kind of just was doing something just in the hope that it would, you know, get him to the next place. But somebody who really, really enjoyed life. But I just love that, because I've been in that situation myself where someone kind of looks you in the eye and says,
do you know what this is about? Well, of course, Michael, just briefly before we move on, around that time, Sheehy's were 10 a penny against Charlie Haughey, as we remember. And I suppose times have changed. You know, Taoiseach and party leaders a little better insulated now and so on. But there's talk again of maybe Heaves in the paper today. I see John Lee in the Mail and Jean Kerrigan in the Sunday Independent are kind of hinting at it, although it's been talked about in recent times in relation to Micheál Martin.
That's right, yeah. John Lee, I noticed, saying it's not a question of when, it's if. Interestingly, Jennifer Brain, the Irish Times, was writing that the numbers are apparently nearly there for a challenge. There's no doubt about it. If Fianna Fáil, Damien, stays on 11%, there will be a heave against Micheál Martin. Now, it won't happen while the pandemic is still with us. It would be inappropriate. Also, there'd be a lot of anger, I think, out there if there was an internal struggle for power within Fianna Fáil while people are suffering under the pandemic. The one thing that might save Micheál Martin is a post-pandemic bounce in the polls. Now, there's no guarantee that this will happen, but it could happen. I think the focus will be on Jim O'Callaghan, Dublin-based. I think Micheál Martin made a strategic mistake in not giving Jim O'Callaghan a senior ministry. Better to have him inside the tent than outside the tent.
He was offered a junior and he declined it. That's
he was
what
offered
we hear
a junior earlier, and he turned it down.
Okay.
The focus is on him.
All right, Michael. Sorry, listen, I'm going to move on. But listen, it's great to hear you on. Thanks a million for that. And that little reminder of, I suppose, a significant part of fairly recent political history in this country. The late Doc Sean Doherty there and the interview with the late Shea Healy being remembered so fondly this weekend. We have a text in here, Anthony. The medics and all the talking heads, like your guests, will only be satisfied when there's been 2 months without a new case. That's just not practical. That's from Liam in Limerick. So I put that to you as I ask you on the eve of the further easing of restrictions, your feelings on that. Tomorrow we can move outside the 5K. I think 200,000 more teenagers going back to school and residential building is allowed back again, among other things. How do you feel?
I'm somewhat worried. We're learning a lot more about long COVID. There have been 3 huge papers published about it in the last 14 days, and they are very, very worrying. It's likely there will be more cases. I know that NPHET have been arguing that the rise in school children is nothing to do with schools. All I can say about that is I don't believe it, and the international evidence is strongly, strongly, strongly against them. But we're going to find out. So it's very important that as we go back to schools, everyone keeps up the ventilation, everyone keeps up all the measures they can to make them safe. The messages that the population needs to get hold of are get vaccinated as soon as you can and stay outdoors, because we know the transmission risks are much lower outdoors than indoors.
And Darren, what's the mood in the UK ahead of tomorrow?
Well, clearly a big day here tomorrow. You know, pubs and restaurants are going to reopen for people outdoors, hairdressers, gyms. You know, it really is a significant day.
Oh, you're making us all so jealous here.
You know, I'm not joking. I'm really quite looking forward to it. I mean, it's a bit cold, but at least the sun's shining of having a pint in a beer garden. And, you know, it has been a long lockdown. And actually, you know, the UK and Ireland have gone through some of the longest, harshest lockdowns of anywhere in Europe, really, since Christmas. So I think people are relieved. The big question here, actually, is not just about case numbers. It's clearly that connection between case numbers, hospitalizations and deaths. And, you know, the increasing studies that link may well have been broken. But also big debates about herd immunity, whether we're getting to that in the UK, because when you combine the number of people who've received the vaccine, the first dose, and we know the first dose is pretty effective, combined with those that have had the virus, particularly younger people, I think UCL, University College London, this week were suggesting that the UK is on the verge of herd immunity. I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but that is that is an interesting possibility. That means that even if cases increase a little bit in the weeks to come, that actually we should not see another lockdown, that this really is irreversible, as Boris Johnson continues to say.
Well, look, Darren, enjoy your pint in the sunshine tomorrow. We'll be all thinking of you. Have one for us as well.
I'll say slauncher.
I do, yeah. And the best of luck in your new role as well. We look
thank
forward to chatting
much.
With you
thank
again.
You.
Thanks so much. And of course, a great reporter with Euronews in Brussels over the years. So look, I have about a minute left. Do you have anything to add there, Dervil, Anthony?
I find myself in the strange position of being the one of my only siblings who either hasn't had the vaccine or hasn't... because, of course, my age group has been called forward in Northern Ireland. I really, really do look forward to lifting the 60s, not least because my involuntary membership of the Grey Hair Don't Care Brigade is I'm beginning to be stressful for people more than I individually. But look, it's a complicated kind of thing. But I think that if we at least knew that the end was in sight and we knew that if we reached a certain point, all of these things would be opening up. But the biggest, brightest hope has to be the vaccines.
Anthony?
It'll be this autumn. I mean, the UK stuff about herd immunity is coming from a bunch of neuroradiologists who don't know what they're talking about. So
how do you respond, though, to people that say, you know, you're being overcautious, scaremongering, you know, there's a, I'm sure you're aware of that. There is a text in here, Anthony Staines, wallowing in fear, mongering, enough is enough and we must get back to normal. That's from Mike in Cork. Now, do you understand that sentiment?
Absolutely, I get it. But I also get talking to my colleagues who are sitting in intensive care units, watching people get sick, watching people die. I talk to people who are looking after patients with long COVID. I know people who have long COVID. I see both sides of it. And that's why we've argued since this began, we need to bring this under control fast. We nearly did it in June last summer, and then keep it under control. And then we can get our lives back. You know, I don't, you can't see my hair because it's facing the other way to the camera. But if you could, it's positively frightening. So if we bring it under control, we can get our lives back. We have to bring it under control some way. Vaccination will get us there unless we're unlucky with a new strain by the autumn.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to thank you both very much. Darren, thank you indeed there in London. And Anthony Staines, Professor of Health Systems at DCU, and Dervil McDonnell, author and broadcaster. I nearly didn't recognise both of you with the hair this morning, no more than he didn't be coming down here. Somebody's just texted in here. People from the South really have no clue about the North, no more than the British do. So maybe that's a fair enough text from that listener. So thank you both very much indeed for joining us. Safe home. Enjoy the sunshine if it's still there.